Hello, Bill. Bill.
Hello, Matt.
Welcome to the DMZ.
Pleasure to be here today. Up here in northern DMZ, I think it's more reverby, more echoey than in southern DMZ.
Yeah, well, you know, we'll do what we can, and hopefully the audio will be as close to normal as we can get it.
You have upgraded.
We had a big week this week with an election, and I want to talk about it. What was your take? Obviously, Scott Walker survived the recall, and this has been something we've been hearing about for months. And was it a big setback for the left, Bill, or not?
Well, it sort of raises the question, you know, and Barney Frank, who has a history of criticizing the left on tactics, suggesting this was the wrong fight to pick. It was a heavy lift. You know, a recall is not something that happens every day. And if you don't, you know, if it's the old adage, if you're going to take a shot at the king, you better take him out or suffer the consequences. So it certainly raises that.
That's a very good point. They pulled a gun. If you pull a gun, you have to pull the trigger. And now it sort of makes them look impotent, I think. It would have been better to have not done this than to have done it and failed, because that really emboldens the other side.
And there's plenty of commentary to suggest that, and I'm not saying it's illegitimate commentary, but I do think there are other counter points here that do make it a bit of a complicated question. Number one, they did take back the Senate. And the risk in not taking out the king is that you will have emboldened him or her to be twice as bad as they were previously. You know, for example, Joe Lieberman, who was, you know, way worse after.
Well, it's not just, it emboldens them because it shows that you can't kill them.
Well, so that's the risk.
Before, there's always the fear. Yeah, but, and now it's proven, like, I can make you mad, and there's nothing you can do about it.
But in this case, it's mitigated because now Walker does not have free reign for the rest of the Wisconsin legislative session because he doesn't control the Senate anymore.
But my understanding, Bill, and I could be wrong, but I heard that is a moot point because they're out of session now and there will be an election where Republicans will probably take back the Senate. And so it's a symbolic victory, but it won't have any actual impact.
Well, I guess it remains to be seen what happens in November. So it doesn't have the immediate impact of stalling Walker, but it certainly, I think, has to give one pause. It's not so clean that Walker's agenda has been validated. Walker still has to ask, because there is that one exit poll question that seems very key. Do you think it's appropriate to recall in all circumstances or only in cases of official misconduct? And it seems like Walker got a certain degree of support, not from people who loved what he did. You know, the numbers on the collective bargaining deal were slightly on Walker's side, but not exactly the same as his victory number. So there seems to be a portion of that which are people that didn't like what he did, but thought it didn't rise to the level of recall worthy. So he has to.
I think you're right about that. I definitely think there was a certain percentage of people who will probably vote against Walker next time, and will probably vote for Obama, but felt that the recall was not appropriate, and that this isn't how we should be, you know, governing, and that it was inappropriate. So
right.
I think that's totally right, and I think that is something that the other side, as you noted, I mean, the left. The Democrats, like, brought this on themselves. They decided to do this. And I think that, in a sense, they were punished for that. That the voters – I think some voters felt like, I don't like the recall idea. Even if I don't like Walker, I don't like the recall idea. And I think some other voters just punished the people for bringing the divisiveness to Wisconsin.
Right.
That this is
– Yeah, this is the thing that, like, frustrates the left because – You know, one of the reasons why you could argue the left had to do this, more emotionally than rationally perhaps, is a sense that Washington Democrats, you know, don't fight to the bitter end They're always pulling their punches. They're always worried about that sort of backlash offending the swing voter and not just laying it on the table and trying to show the broader public that they have the courage of their convictions. And this seemed to be an opportunity for the left to do it their way. You know, we're gonna take this to the bitter end and show that it has merit. And now maybe they end up losing the argument because they didn't pull it off. But I think you can combine the fact that recall did work at the legislative level. And the other point here is, you know, there was the case in Ohio where they successfully repealed a similar collective bargaining rollback from Governor Kasich.
Right. But see, but here's the interesting thing, though, Bill, about what happened in Ohio. If you're a governor, if you're a Republican governor, I think that the lesson you learn from Ohio and Wisconsin is you have to go all in. Kasich, and I'm not an expert on what happened in Ohio, but my understanding is that Kasich tried to actually be more diplomatic and more bipartisan and spread the pain around a little bit more. And it wasn't – what he did wasn't as bold and as controversial as what Walker did. Walker prospered. Kasich did not. And so I think the message is copy Walker.
Well, I saw Walker's acceptance speech on Tuesday night, and I'm not an expert on everything Walker has said over the past 6 months. But there were elements of – there was a bit of a conciliatory tone. It wasn't an FU speech. He was like, you know, I understand that maybe – you know, we went too far, too fast without talking about what we wanted to do with the voters. You know, there was a bit of a, you know, I realize I was a little rough around the edges there. So I don't know if it's quite right that Walker had a completely pugnacious approach to this. But, you know, there's obviously there's different ways to interpret what happened. But I do think at least if you're coming in from the vantage point of the left, you can say to yourself, you know what, we put the foot on the gas. We didn't get everything that we wanted, but we put enough fear into conservative governors that if you're being wide-eyed about it, you have to say to yourself, you know what, this is not a risk-free proposition. To go after public sector unions, there is a risk of backlash. There's a risk that you will anger people who are not necessarily in those unions, because remember, there's very few people actually in the unions, in any union for that matter. And if it may be now that a lot of these governors forget Ohio, forget what happened on the legislative level in Wisconsin, just look at Walker's numbers and say, I want to go balls out too because Walker didn't, it worked. But it may be that it's not that simple, that there still are risks involved either way. There's risks involved, you know, going all out on the recall front. There's risks involved going all out trying to break the unions. So I do see this as a bit of a split decision, and I certainly don't think that the left is going to be sheepish about trying to do this in the future. I think they are telling themselves that we got something out of this. You know, we don't walk away empty-handed. And two, it's not our fault; it's the money's fault. And we need to find a way to take out Citizens United if we're going to solve these problems. It's not a question of us being a poor strategist, the way Barney Frank said. We need to stop the money. Now, the problem with that analysis is it's hard to stop the money. But I think that's where the mindset of the left is right now.
Well, I think that you are putting a little bit of a happy face on this for the left. I think it was a crushing blow and a devastating defeat. Having said that, I think that just as it was a mistake for the left to do this, I think that you can always overread success, and that while I disagree that this gives anything for Republicans to fear, I actually think this emboldens them. I think that could be dangerous. I think that Republicans should have a little trepidation, because while, you know, it used to be that labor unions were very dangerous to mess with, and that you couldn't touch, you know, pensions and collective bargaining, and that was you know, sort of like a third rail thing, I don't think that it would be wise to cavalierly think that you could replicate this other places. So I think a little modesty would go a long way.
I want to explore that a bit, but first let me be DMZ-ish as well. Let me be modest also. Okay. I don't want to put too big of a happy face on it. Like, I do think there is a warning here for the left that it is possible to overreach. It is possible to be poorly strategic. I think that in going as far as they did in Wisconsin, they still got something out of it, and therefore it's not a total loss. Therefore, I wouldn't second guess them too much. But this does also raise the fact that the way that the base thinks about something, this is true for the right too in a lot of circumstances. You know, it's not a given that the broader electorate's going to intrinsically get where you're coming from. Obviously, the left had a difficult time communicating that what happened was recall worthy and not just your garden variety political disagreement.
Bill, I think there's all, I agree, but I also think there's another factor, which is that federal government employees don't have the right to collective bargain. People who work in private labor unions don't have the benefits that Wisconsin state union employees had in terms of, you know, the percentage that they had to match for pensions and all that. And so I think there was a perception that Wisconsin state employees had a sweet deal. And in a time of economic austerity, when a lot of people are out of work, underemployed, or just don't have benefits themselves, why should they, with their tax dollars, fund some, you know, state bureaucrat to have a sweetheart deal package? I think that the unions thought that the public would be on their side, and I think that there was some resentment among citizens.
Well, I mean, and this is the difficult challenge with this issue, because on one hand, yes, there are definitely other workers who don't have the same kind of packages as the public sector workers do. Of course, you know, it's not like if you're a public sector worker, you live high on the hog. I mean, I don't want to get into a big argument with you about it, but these are not people who are working, you know, six-figure salaries here. But there are also certain benefits that they get that folks then call attention to and say, hey, they have that and you don't. Why is that fair? The challenge for the pro-union side is, of course, to say, hey, we're trying to lift the standards up for everybody. We're trying not to have corporate forces set a low bar for everybody. If we can get this deal, this puts pressure on other businesses to match us so they don't lose talent. We want to raise all boats here. So that's the general challenge that they have in dealing with these sorts of issues. But I would put that aside as far as this recall election was concerned, because as far as I can tell, not being on the ground in Wisconsin, they weren't really debating the collective bargaining agreement at the end of the day. The polling had indicated that the fight over this was in the back of people's minds, too far in the past.
Part of it though was that Kathleen Falk lost. I mean, this was the woman who was supposed to be the candidate about, you know, who most represented the pro union.
This is the person who lost in the Democratic primary,
right, to
Barrett.
Tom Barrett. Who did you see the guy get slapped? Did you see Tom Barrett get slapped?
Yeah. That was unnecessary. That was
brutal.
That was not very DMZ.
That is not DMZ behavior.
He was not in the DMZ in that convention hall that night. But her loss already should have been a warning sign that, you know, even the broader Democratic Party electorate wasn't quite where the union mentality was. Not necessarily, I'm not saying there's a big ideological split, but just sort of in prioritization of issue and energy level and the like. It doesn't seem like Barrett lost because of resentment, worker v. worker resentment. I'm not saying it doesn't exist. I don't think that was the main issue at the end of the day for this particular election. But it does speak to the fact that there wasn't a huge wildfire around that specific issue that lasted for, you know, a two-year stretch. And this is one of the reasons why you could argue it was strategically dicey to push the recall, because just based on the way the Wisconsin rules are, there was going to be distance between the issue that was the impetus for this and the actual election of it. So how do you sustain the enthusiasm for that long period of time?
I think part of it, you know, there was a certain amount of schadenfreude, mainly because Ed Schultz and the good people at MSNBC had made this out to be like it was going to be this huge, you know, if Walker had been recalled. It was funny, I watched Hardball last night. I think it was last night. And they're talking about how Obama killed the number two Al-Qaeda guy, which is a legitimate story. Don't get me wrong. But you know, if Walker had been recalled, it would have been, and by the way, is it recalled or recalled? This is like defense or defense. If Walker had been recalled, it would have been, now a special coverage, we're going to Ed Schultz live from Madison, you know. So they really set this up to be like a big deal, and I think they brought some of it on themselves, some of the criticism. I do think that Republicans need to be careful also not to assume that this means that they can win in November. I mean, maybe they can win, but I still think you have to say that it's probably Obama's to lose. And I think there's an interesting, really ironic thing, which is that one of the reasons that Walker, I think, survived is that things have been fairly good in Wisconsin of late. First time in a dozen years that property taxes went down.
Well, look, you know, the Wisconsin exit poll was essentially pro-Walker and pro-Obama.
Right.
And it was a pro-incumbent, not angry electorate.
Exactly, and I think that is part and parcel of things turning around in Wisconsin and the economy getting better, jobs being added, and I think that just as Walker was rewarded for that, I think Obama could just as well be rewarded for that, and it may make some Republicans want to pull their hair out, but I think it's entirely possible that, you know, voters who are like, things are getting a little bit better, let's not change horses in the middle of the stream, apply that same standard to Obama.
I mean, some folks on the left are angry with Obama that he wasn't on the ground in Wisconsin. He didn't do more.
He did send a tweet, though. You cannot underestimate that.
Right. But again, this is where, you know, again, I think there was some strategic sense in what they did do. I do think they got something out of all this. But to think that there is no risk, no cost involved in taking something this far, it doesn't add up, because you look at the exit poll number. I mean, clearly there is a portion of the Wisconsin electorate who doesn't love Scott Walker, but still likes Obama. And so if Obama went all in on this and risked his brand of trying to unite people, which I would argue still exists, you might disagree, I know, you know, if you risk that in taking a clear-cut side on this and being seen as more of a partisan fighter, those exit polls might not have come out the same way.
Well, I knew, though, too, Bill. I knew about 2 weeks ago that Walker would win, because we started seeing blind quotes in the Washington Post of top Obama administration officials and DNC aides and the like, talking about what a bad campaign that Barrett had run. And it's funny, because I saw the exact same thing about 2 weeks before Cray Deeds lost in Virginia to Bob McDonnell, and I saw the same thing about a week or two before Martha Coakley lost to Scott Brown in Massachusetts. So there is an interesting pattern of the DNC and Obama's folks of once they find out someone's going to lose, they start distancing the president from them. It's probably smart politics, but it's not exactly a profile in courage either.
Well, again, it's one thing if this – I mean, I think there's some folks to the left that really saw this as a do or die. You know, if you can't do this, you know, what's the point? I mean, I saw some you know, sort
there's
of, you
a video.
Know,
did you see the video of the guy talking about how democracy died?
Right. I mean, there's definitely that sentiment
out there.
Have
you seen that video?
There.
It's hilarious.
And I think if you're the president, you're saying, look, this isn't everything. if Obama wins re-election, we will get to do other good things. So you don't have to risk it all on this one recall election, as distasteful as the collective bargaining legislation is and how it was rammed through. How awful it is that, you know, there was a lot of outside money here and the Democrats are wildly outspent and that doesn't speak well for how Citizens United is going to work in November. You know, you could acknowledge all that and say, you know what, you know, I don't have to put all my chips right here. There's another game to be played that I'm still looking pretty good in. And I'm going to make some strategic decisions as far as resource allocation, political capital to make sure I'm viable there. That's not crazy for Obama to do, just as it's not crazy for the unions to have tried to push it as far as they did, because, you know, and from their perspective, you know, they don't want these types of anti-collective bargaining laws to become the baseline. If they become the baseline, you know, the union movement's already, you know, way back on its heels. Like, that would be the death blow. So they have a rational strategic decision to say, we have to do everything we can to put the fear in God of other conservatives that might think of doing this. So they didn't have the luxury necessarily to be cute and coy where to pick their battles. And they're going to do their best to argue, look, we still made our case. We still communicate. We still were able to show that there's political risk in picking a fight with us on this. So do it at your, buyer beware, wherever the proper rhetorical phrase is. And whether they'll succeed in making conservatives second guess, I don't know. There was some second guessing after Ohio, as there was second guessing once the recall petitions were launched. You haven't seen Republican governors replicate this so much as of late. We'll see if they have a second win with it. But that's why the unions did what they did, understandably, and I think Obama did what he did to keep himself viable for November, understandably.
Well, so there's something else, Bill, that I've been noticing that is really interesting, and I'm starting to think that it's not just a coincidence. And that is that it appears that loyalists of the Secretary of State are undermining the president. And it's happened a lot. And I'm specifically thinking of Bill Clinton and Ed Rendell. But if something happens once or twice, you start to think it's just a coincidence. But is it just me, Bill, or is there afoot?
Well, certainly not just you. But every time there's a hint of daylight between Clinton and Obama, you know, people love parsing Clinton. People love to parse Clinton ever since he was president. And there's always people trying to spin out wild conspiracy theories what might be going on. I personally think that it doesn't make a lot of sense that he wants to undermine Obama's reelection. It doesn't really help Hillary, if she's going to run in 2016, to have an incumbent Republican in there. Any seasoned political professional would say, look, you have no idea what 2016 is going to look like. So you can't. There's no way to gauge whether it makes sense to have whether the Republican be intrinsically unpopular and therefore be easy pickings, or would it be best to have a two-term Obama handed off to pass the torch. You know, you have no idea what 2016 is going to look like. So any professional is not going to game it out, you know, at that level.
Could it be, though? I mean, could it be that Clinton really still, because remember how bitter that primary was.
Yes.
And Bill Clinton said, well, yeah, he won South Carolina, but Jesse Jackson won it too. And it was bitter, and Clinton was very petty, a lot of people felt. And, you know, maybe he likes being the only two-term Democrat around. Maybe it's not a strategic thing to help Hillary as much as it's that he's never really liked Obama. He kind of resents him, and he's not going to humble himself to talk the talking points. If someone asks him a question, This goes back to my point about Cory Booker a few weeks ago, where he was acting as a surrogate, and I argued that if you are a surrogate, then you have to basically be a tool. You have to suck it up and give the talking points. And nobody expects you to be intellectually honest. You're not a journalist. You're not, you know, once you put on that hat as a surrogate. And I think it's reasonable to expect that Bill Clinton would say things that help Barack Obama. And he seems actually more interested in saying things that are true, such as that Mitt Romney had a sterling business career. That's not really helpful to Barack Obama. And it could it just be that he's not going to subject himself to the traditional political role because he has no interest in it?
Well, I think that's largely correct. I mean, and it could be completely correct. The thing I only hesitate on is that I can't get into his head. I don't know what degree of resentment he currently carries around with him on a daily basis. It could well be a lot, but I just don't think I can know. But I do think it has to be the case that he does not feel it is required of him to subjugate himself to what Obama's talking points are. I think he believes his own hype that he is uniquely gifted in communicating political concepts and ideas and strategic positioning and all the like. And therefore, he's going to say what he's going to say and expect that everyone else is going to follow his lead. And I think there's a lot of other Democrats out there that would agree with that. I do think Clinton is better than Obama on this score. And other folks think that Obama's better on this
score
than Clinton.
But I think if Bill Clinton were running for president against Mitt Romney, he wouldn't be saying Mitt Romney has a sterling business record. He would be doing the same thing that Obama's doing, because that's what Republicans did. That's what makes sense. That's how you beat Mitt Romney. I mean, the Bain issue is. And you know how that ties into income inequality, and what we saw in Wisconsin. I mean, these are larger trends, and Clinton isn't just singing off a different choir sheet. He's at a different church. He is actually providing aid and comfort to the other side's argument.
It's his intention to help Romney over Obama. That just doesn't add up to me. And that may be the effect of what he's doing in some of these cases, but I don't think it's what his intention is. He came of age. What he did in the 90s was to sell himself as a more business-friendly Democrat and break from certain Democratic orthodoxies on the score. Remember, a lot of the financial deregulation that had happened was done on his watch, not under duress, that actively shaped
that's
it.
That's a good point. Yeah, that's a good point.
And so I think he sincerely believes that Democrats need to be careful with their rhetoric to not to overly offend Wall Street. And that's not a view I think that Obama is 180 degrees opposed to. I mean, I think Obama tries to be careful with his rhetoric too. But I think to the degree that Obama leans towards the popular side of things rhetoric-wise is not exactly where Bill Clinton is. And so when there is a divergence in style and approach and prioritization and the like, people notice it and call attention to it. I think what Clinton's trying to say there is he's trying to give his elder statesman counsel that this is the way to go after Romney. Let's not beat up too much on the business record. Let's talk about the policies. This is the way to do it. And the Obama team is trying to say, look, going after bio is a key part of making the case against his policies. We're not on some wonk seminar here, people. We're in an election, and you got to make a gut level case. Why wouldn't Bill Clinton understand that? That guy's not he didn't run for president, strictly on the basis of policy papers. It's interesting where the divergence is happening, but I do think it's rooted in a desire to find the sweet spot of political messaging. I don't think it's a huge ideological difference
to have You better, Bill?
Yeah, I just think you have a bit of a, for lack of a better word, grudge match in that, you know, Clinton can't give up the mantle of chief messenger, doesn't want to give up the mantle of chief messenger. When he was asked by Brian Williams at NBC, you know, why aren't you being more of a team player? And Clinton said, that's not my job. I think he believes that. He thinks that it's not my job to follow what they say. He thinks it's his job to set the framework where what everybody else should say.
Well, I think that's inappropriate. I think that
I agree with you, but I just think that that's where his head is at.
Maybe, but look, how about don't forget about the fact that his wife is the Secretary of State. I mean, this is incredibly awkward to have.
The whole thing is awkward.
And she is part of the administration, and in my opinion, that means he should shut up or get in line. And Ed Rendell, I think, was a big Hillary supporter. He's been, you know, also creating some issues too with his commentary on MSNBC. So anyway,
he's a bit less of a. I mean, Clinton, Bill Clinton is married to someone who's part of the administration. And being a president too, you might think he would say, look, you know, this is not my place to get involved in the race.
Right.
You know,
I'm
not getting some political questions.
Don't comment. You know, don't go on TV every 5 minutes if you're not going to tote the party line.
Right.
He's not a free agent, as far as I'm
concerned. But Rendell, I mean, Rendell's more of a free agent at this point. I mean, I don't like what Rendell's doing personally, but I think he has more of a freedom to do it if he wants to upset the apple cart, he can upset the apple cart.
Right. Rendell can do whatever he wants. I just think in lieu of what Clinton's doing, it seems to me very interesting, and I'll end it where I started it, that the president's, you know, two very close allies of the Secretary of State seem to be undermining, on a fairly regular basis, the President of the United States. I'll leave it at that.
Well, I'll ask you this question, though. I have my opinion about this, but I want to ask you.
Yeah.
Who is the better communicator?
I think that Bill Clinton is one of the best politicians, one of the best gut politicians, certainly of the 20th century, certainly of the last half of the 20th century. I think that if Bill Clinton's running for president, Bill Clinton is a very good communicator. I mean, there's some undisciplinedness, but by and large, I think that Bill Clinton is more naturally talented. But who cares more about reelecting Barack Obama or Bill Clinton? And I think that is the fundamental point. I don't think that Bill Clinton necessarily has Obama's best interest in mind. Maybe he's trying to undermine him, or maybe he just doesn't care. Either way, it doesn't really matter if you're Barack Obama. I think Obama has the right strategy. As much as I may disagree politically and substantively with it, I think that Obama knows how to win. And I think, you know, it's not going to be an easy win. It's going to be a slog. But I think Obama and his team have settled on a strategy and a message. And whether it's a good one or not, you have to honor that. And I think Clinton's stepping on it and undermining it. And remember, Bill Clinton wasn't that great at helping his wife either. Sometimes these things aren't transferable. And
I also think that, you know, what people seem to talk about now with Clinton is say, well, Clinton is so good when he explains the economy. He really makes everyone understand. He takes his complicated concepts, and everyone now grasps it when he says it. And I think Clinton's no slouch. I'm not trying to be too
dismissive. Well, he does spend a couple hours a day studying the economy as well.
And I hear Donald Trump is really smart, too.
I'm very smart.
I do think that people forget that Clinton had a lot of difficulties when he was president, too.
Here's the other thing, too. How much of Bill Clinton's oomph came from him being like a young Southern governor? I mean, I think to a certain degree, some of his cachet, some of his charisma came from virtue of the fact that he was like young, good-looking, cool, Southern governor. I mean, he's none of those things anymore. he's
we still well he still has the still has the draw, and I do think that he gets
he basically lives in like Harlem. And he's old.
Well, Chappaqua.
I think he's a vegetarian or something. And
but
you get my point, though.
But I do think that when he talks about economic concepts in his Southern drawl, you know, almost by definition, it doesn't sound like an economic seminar. And that's good. I mean, that's a good use of his natural ability. So I'm not knocking him for that. But I don't think, you know, I hear Clinton talk about the economy and Obama talk about the economy. I don't feel like, as far as the actual, you know, reading level of words that they're using, length of time that they spend, use of catchy sound bites, they both do it. They both have their styles. But I do think they both are pretty adept at taking complicated concepts and communicating them in a way that people can grasp. Just that some concepts are really complicated. It's not like Clinton did such a bang-up job explaining his healthcare plan. I mean, I was watching Hardball 2 the other day, and they were saying how Clinton does this fantastic job explaining European austerity at the Obama fundraiser, and Obama's done such a terrible job communicating healthcare. Well, so did Clinton. I mean, Clinton did such a bad job of it that they didn't pass it. Healthcare's complicated.
Like some of this is revisionist history and sort of like a good old boys journalist conventional wisdom thing. And some of it's true.
And I think that people tend to give a lot more slack to the guy who's not, you know, in the middle of it, in the arena right now, not taking all the slings and the punches, and just have the revisionist history, as you said. So I only bring this up not to, you know, re-engage the grudge match per se, but I do think if people were to look at the two figures, I don't think it makes sense to say Clinton is inherently the better communicator, therefore Obama should be doing what he's doing. That doesn't add up to me.
I think if Bill Clinton, if it's 1992 and Bill Clinton is running himself, Bill Clinton is one of the best strategists in the Democratic Party. But does Bill Clinton care as much about electing Barack Obama as he cares about Bill Clinton? I question his motives and his loyalties. And so I don't care if Bill Clinton's the best strategist in the world. When you're the incumbent president, you get to decide the message and the strategy, and everyone else needs, if they want to be helpful, to get in line or shut.
But, you know, Democrats are generally bad at doing that. And they were bad at doing it when Clinton was president, and they're bad at it now that Obama's president.
You keep saying that, and I, by and large, find you to be wrong. But in recent weeks, I think you're on to something. Do you want to end it there, Bill, or do you want to call
well,
it
well, you have your big you idea. You have your big idea.
Do you want to do the big idea?
Yeah.
I don't know if these are big ideas or big debates. We got to brand this, but the big idea, the thing that I wrote about, I think late last week, which I think is interesting, there was a guy at Business Insider who wrote a piece. Let me give you his name, Henry Blodgett. I think he is one of the big wigs, if not the big wig over there. He wrote a piece basically saying what all of us know, which is that, you know, if it wasn't for sports and breaking news, we wouldn't have cable TV. And if there's a time when HBO or when ESPN, all the contracts are up, if ESPN could stream football, there's really no need to have, you know, to have cable. I mean, I have the Apple TV. There's Netflix. There's Hulu. There's obviously TiVo, but maybe that undercuts my point. But so many people watch streaming video or things now. You almost, just like nobody has a home phone anymore, you almost don't need cable TV anymore. And
I don't have cable TV right now. I'm a cord cutter.
You are a prime example of that. So you're proving my point. So this means if you don't have cable TV, it means cable news. And that's what I wrote about, because he didn't really address cable news per se. And I made the point that if this trend continues, and have every reason to suspect it will, then cable news, you know, the cable networks could die out, or I think more likely change. I think that part of what's happened with cable TV is that in order to get better ratings, they've kind of sexed it up and dumbed it down. And I think that what could happen is that certainly cable news won't go away. But, I mean, what is stopping the Daily Beast from having Howard Kurtz do a show there, or Kirsten Powers do a show there? Or, I mean, think of, you know, many, many websites, the Huffington Post, prime example. Like, why couldn't Arianna Huffington have a show there? That, I mean, if you're watching FoxNews.com and MSNBCNews.com streaming anyway, there's no built-in advantage to being on cable TV anymore, then things could flatten, and I think that you could have sort of like what happened with radio, where, you know, commercial terrestrial radio, it used to be more interesting, and then toward the end it got really dumbed down, where you had, like, you know, the ad department and producers saying, well, you know, play more Eagles, you know. No Elvis Costello, just play the same hits over and over and over again, because that's what people want. And XM, Sirius, and all that stuff, and iPods now allow people to listen to what they want when they want to, or at least more interesting niche programming. So, I don't know, I throw it out. Why is that where we're headed with cable TV? Could future have more interesting, more variety, and more competition in sort of political punditry?
Well, I mean, I agree with you that I think there is a risk of cable news collapsing. I would diverge and say I'm not sure that's a good thing, but you know, the damage arguably is done. But the shift has already happened away from actual reporting. I mean, cable TV operations are not buoyed by investigative journalism. They're buoyed by opinion shows in prime time, which are cheaper to produce. You don't have to hire bureaus in several foreign countries to do news gathering to have an opinion-based show.
The other point to that is that that could easily be replicated by us.
Right. I mean, we need to have a 24-hour network to sustain a large news gathering operation. Or you need to be connected to a network of broadcast TV, NBC Nightly News, ABC News, whatever, you know, and that's a profit center. You know, it used to be that you had to have some kind of public service programming to warrant your access to the public broadcast spectrum, and now that's not really what's keeping the TV news business together. So, you know, it's already moving in the direction, which I think is a bad one, away from, I mean, I'm not against opinion shows, but I would like there to be more balance between, you know, opinion-based shows and actual, you know, hard reporting shows. But that's already happening. So I guess what is the open question is, do you need to have a cable TV apparatus for pundits to have platforms? So it's very possible, as you said, that it may just all happen on websites.
What happens now?
And on smartphones going forward, because you don't need to have a cable distribution to do that kind of thing.
Well, what happens now, I think, is that people, when there is an emergency, they turn to CNN. And when there's not an emergency, they watch Fox or MSNBC. And if that's the case, you could still see CNN and CNN.com sort of thriving. But you could see, I think, as people move off cable, some leveling. And I think that there is this opportunity for smart punditry. Because I think that, just as terrestrial radio, in order to get ratings, became dumber. Hey, Bob, traffic and weather together on the nines. Hey, how's it going? Let's play another hit coming up from Coldplay. I mean, that sort of shtick. Terrestrial radio got dumber and dumber, and it was all done under the guise of improving ratings. It was all done by the suits who went away to some conference somewhere, or you know, the program directors, the ad department. And at the end of the day, it got really crappy radio, and it was easily, once the technology presented itself, it was easily discarded in favor of satellite radio and podcasts. And I mean, right now, you know, there are if you think about it, there you know, the trend is for us to find sort of niche programming. And obviously there's Blogging Heads and Charlie Rose and podcasts. So I really think it's very possible that you could see a flattening where cable news is news, but the commentary part, the stuff that gets the ratings on, you know, the 363 days out of the year when there isn't an emergency or some sort of, you know, breaking news story, could go to, you know, other outlets. I mean, why? What is stopping Hulu from or Netflix from broadcasting a show that I produce here at the Daily Caller? I mean,
I think the problem with the model you're talking about is, and look, I think you may be right that we're moving in this direction, but to actually have smart reporting that is particularly useful in a breaking news situation where you're trying to understand a fast-moving, complicated subject requires a lot of investment in human capital that doesn't have instant payoff. And what I fear is a lot of executives are grasping that when a breaking news event happens, people don't care necessarily if you have the smartest team of reporters available to handle it. People just want to see, you know, they want to see the video as fast as they can. They're happy to get, rumors, you know, across the transit. People, I see on all the time on Twitter, people crowing that they're getting information on Twitter faster than they're getting on CNN. Without one thought towards how good is this information are you getting? You're getting raw data, but you're not getting reported data. You're getting rumor. You're getting quick takes. But there is a certain, you know, fun satisfaction that, look, I get it too. I'm not saying I'm higher or minor than everybody else. You know, it is fun to feel like you're at the edge of your seat in the middle of a news story. And it's fun to keep clicking on the on various websites or watching your tweet deck stream go and see what thing might pop up next. But it's not necessarily the most educational thing you could be doing with yourself in the middle of a breaking news situation.
Right.
So if there's no one willing to put the investment into the human reporting capital, you're just not going to have that exist anymore, or it's going to exist in very niche situations that only a few people are going to access.
I think you're right, and I think it's concerning, but I think it's a separate topic. I mean, I guess the point I'm making is that in order to be in order to get ratings and to keep costs down, cable news shifted to a pundit paradigm. And ironically, it was sort of like drinking Drano. It fills you up, but it leaves you empty inside. By doing that, in the short term, it allowed them to make easy profits and get ratings. But in the long term, I think it makes them vulnerable to outside competition if people start canceling their cable systems and it goes to streaming video. And if you look at some of the stuff the Young Turks have done, Glenn Beck TV, it seems plausible. And my hope is that while there may be serious problems in terms of news coverage, that the punditry might actually get better and smarter and more diverse. So there's a serious question about the news coverage, but I am optimistic that this could be very good for the state of punditry and commentary.
Well, why don't we leave it on that note, Mr. Lewis?
All right, man. good talking with you, as always.
You too, sir. I'll be able to see you in D.C. soon.
Yes, we're going to have a powwow. Is it the second or third? I think maybe the third time we've actually set eyes on each other face-to-face.
I think so.
Second or third time.
But my group, Campaign for America's Future, is having a big conference in D.C. on the 18th, 19th, and 20th, Take Back the American Dream.
That's funny. Paul I thought Krugman. We were going to take back the American Dream. we're defending the American Dream. You're taking it back. That's how it is. Okay.
But Paul Krugman, Chris Hayes, Melissa Harris-Perry, Van Jones, Bernie Sanders, you know, lots of folks are going to be there. So if folks are interested, artfuture.org/takeback. So I'll be in D.C. for a few days, and perhaps you and I can get a nosh.
Let's do it. All right, man.
All right.
Have a good one.
Take care.